the reason these disturbances, they followed you to a new home, is because it's not the house that's haunted. It's your son.
So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
You get another beer, you want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit. Oh.
My name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. You found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do.
California, stay away from me. Stay away from me. I'll come with you. John Doe has the upper hand.
And on that day, Ahab will go to his grave, but he'll rise again within the hour. He will rise and beckon. Then all save one shall follow.
They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you!
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going, sir?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. And we have a Connecticut American.
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you, sir? Or Madeline.
I am doing great. I am doing great.
Excellent. Abe from Massachusetts will be joining us a little later. He is still wrapping up some of the movie because he started it very late for some reason. And he watched it the day of. But before we get into the topic and all that, we do have a couple of house cleaning things. First off, Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan. Why don't you let folks know about it?
It is a general interest podcast called the Askansity Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find it on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, and Spotify.
Excellent. And Mike, you do a couple of podcasts with myself and Eric besides this one, and you have a sometimes blog?
Yeah, the blog is Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com. The cats are calling out for me. They're demanding that we get more You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, which is the Game of Thrones podcast that should be returning April, what, Phil?
Probably April 7th or 6th or something like that, right okay. Before the season starts, because we'll do a preliminary episode.
All right. And then there's Searching for American Gods, based on the Starz TV series American Gods. That might be returning in March. And then there's Bullets, Prophets, and Bots, the Westworld podcast, which will be returning whenever the HBO show Westworld returns to screens.
Excellent. And Chrissy, you do things.
I do. I write short dark fiction. Right now, my website has not been too active as far as blogging because I've been busy working on a few actual writing projects. But you can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
That's right. And another good thing about all the co-hosts is you can always reach us on Facebook at the Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. So join, just search for Dark Discussions Podcast. We are over there and conversations are happening. Also, we have a Twitter account and email. darkdiscussions@aol.com is the email. We can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. And at the bottom of every page of darkdiscussions.com are links to all these things. What else can people find on darkdiscussions.com, Eric?
They can find a bunch of stuff. On the front page, you will find links to all of our friends on the right-hand side. You'll also find links at the top of the page. The one that says audio will bring you to every single episode of every single one of the podcasts that was just mentioned that's Dark Discussions affiliated for free. So you can download any of the past episodes from there. You can also find on the front page an articles link that has articles written by myself as well as others. And you can also find a link to our I almost said Spotify account. That's not right. You can find a link to our Patreon account. Patreon is a service that lets you support online artists. Producing this podcast is not free. So if you'd like to help us offset the cost of producing the podcast, you can donate. For every $5 a month you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the show. We take all the submissions and draw them on a quarterly basis. For more details, you can go follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions.
Excellent. And what Dark Discussions is, for new listeners, that's a podcast that discusses genre films. So horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, midnight movies, drive-in, and sometimes art house foreign films and whatnot. Also on the Dark Discussions feed is Anthony T's horror show. He is a folk that myself and Mike know from conventions. We met him through conventions, and he actually now has a podcast and talks horror and so forth in a podcast that's usually bi-monthly. Also, there's Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Reviews, which is a podcast that I've been doing quarterly, which talks about boutique label, art house type films, usually 4 to 6, and I give my opinions of the movies, but also the discs that have, you know, the extras and whatever. Tonight is actually a Patreon pick, so we'll discuss that when we get to it. But before we do that, is there anybody that has any news or information they want to give up? I do know that the Horror Mafia podcast has released their top 15 horror films of the year episode. They have 4 co-hosts, and they discuss individual lists. They don't have a list that they combine for a definitive the Horror Mafia podcast.
Yes. Yeah, I listened to that, Phil. It was interesting. I found their number one picks to be quite intriguing.
Yes, I know you would. Yes. It was by default, all 4 said Hereditary. I did have some issue with Joey, who mentioned that this was a real horror film, unlike the 1980s stuff like Nightmare on Elm Street. And I was like horrified that he said that. I assume he's talking about the sequels, but the original by Wes Craven by far is a true horror film. And so I don't know what he was talking about. So
maybe you can get another guest spot on the show and argue with him about it.
Did they have any comments on the RoboCop remake called Upgrade?
Yes, that made their top 10 lists, except for Dawn, because I don't think he saw it.
So they weren't baffled that it was considered horror?
No, they were not. No, believe it or not.
All right. They
all had it in their top 10.
What are you talking about, Mike? You're the one that pushed it into horror.
No, I didn't.
Okay, I guess you said against everybody else.
Well, it was you and me. It was you and me against, I think, Abe and Phil, and just said, all right. Everybody else is putting in horror, so Ty goes to the runner.
All right.
There you go.
Well, I mean,
anyway,
like I said,
let's
stop
spoiling their list and just recommend the episode.
All right.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I just think that, you know, horror, honestly, is really so subjective now because there are so many subgenres. There's so much different stuff. There are so many things that people consider scary. It's just – or not. It's just tough to – classify. I just think it's a different world now. Than it was like years ago when it was pretty cut and dried, you know.
Yeah, there's nothing so horrifying to me as making me go to the theater watch Mamma Mia 2.
Right. Yeah.
But it's what's, you know, and people use different. Is it bloody? Is it gory? Is it terrifying? Is it gothic? There's also, you know, I wasn't scared. It can't be horror. Well, you know, when was the last time any of us were really scared by a horror film? It is very subjective. And
A Quiet Place. I was scared.
Yeah, I tend to default to the, is it something that would appeal to horror fans? That's kind of what I consider to be a horror film.
Oh, Rick? That's, you know, that's a great way of thinking about it. I never thought of it that way, but you're right.
Also, a lot of people now try to not be put into the horror category. They try to spin off to thrillers or psycho thrillers or...
Well, and then there's a whole crowd that doesn't want to acknowledge that a horror movie can be a good movie, so they created elevated horror.
Oh, don't go there with me, Eric.
Or Eric, the psychological thriller. I did want to thank this year's Academy Awards because not a single horror film was nominated for an Academy Award, which only goes to prove that they were actually, in fact, horror movies.
That's right.
Well, you know, that's not quite true because A Quiet Place got nominated, ironically, for sound.
Oh, no, that doesn't count. Nobody gives a shit about sound design.
I actually do.
I think Mike is talking about the awards that everybody tunes into. If
right, the big five or six, you know. Yeah. Picture
but
director
Black
and the
Panther got nominated for Best Picture.
Well, yeah. always bet on Black.
Black Panther is not a horror movie.
Yeah, that's
it's
that.
It's
a
horror film, but it's not.
Yeah, horror. Yeah. It's, if they suddenly started saying, "Well, Black Panther isn't really a comic book movie; it's a social action commentary," you know, that's kind of what horror films have had to deal with, you know. And if Toni Collette, it would have been nominated for a suspense thriller. You know, no, she didn't get nominated. Therefore, Hereditary must be a horror movie,
right? Or Matt Dillon. For best actor.
Right. They didn't see the movie, but everyone raves about that, so.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, Mike, I know you have problems with Lars von Trier, but if you were to watch the movie, I don't think you could deny that Matt Dillon put in a very good performance.
Nope, I'm not. I've got no problem with people saying you should be nominated.
He was awesome.
And you know, all sorts of stuff that could have been nominated this year. It wasn't, and that's fine, but it just confirms that they're all horror films. Because there's old people in the Academy who won't watch those.
Right. And
so the answer is kill them all.
Yes.
Get a new Academy.
More Rodden people joined that are younger.
Was our top 10 episode last week?
Yes. No, 2 weeks ago.
It was released last week.
What was last week?
Class.
Oh, right. It was Class. So, I don't know if we touched on any of the news that's come out last week either, because there were some big things that I noted.
Go ahead.
Well, for me, the most recent and sad news is the passing of the legendary Dick Miller.
Right. Mike, you suggested that we should do a episode on one of his films that he starred in, and that's a good idea, I think.
Yeah. I'm blanking on the name now.
A Bucket of Blood.
The Bucket of Blood. Thank you.
Roger Corman film.
Yeah, it's one of the few films he was the lead in. He starred in.
Yep.
But
Corman directed it too.
Yeah, and most people would know him best for
Gremlins, maybe.
I would say for Mr. Potterman and Gremlins and Gremlins 2, and then he's had, you know, bit parts in every Joe Dante movie. He considered Dick Miller to be his good luck charm. And he's had a bit role in something relatively recently. He was in Terminator. He's the guy that sold Arnold all his gun.
The 12 gauge autoloader.
That's Italian. You can go pump or auto.
The 45 long slide with laser sighting.
These are brand new. We just got them in. That's a good gun. Just touch the trigger, the beam comes on, and you put the red dot where you want the bullet to go. You can't miss. Anything else?
Phased plasma rifle in the 40-watt range.
Hey, just what you see, pal.
The Uzi 9mm.
You know your weapons, buddy. Any one of these is ideal for home defense. So, which will it be?
All.
I may close early today. There's a 15-day wait on handguns, but the rifles you can take right now. You can't do that.
Wrong.
The Don Mancini's version of Chucky, the TV series, not the reboot that's not related to Don Mancini. His TV series spinoff has been picked up by the Sci-Fi Channel. We'll see where that goes, but if people are interested in knowing that. Zack Snyder has best finished convalescing from the loss of his family, and he's jumping back in the director's seat with a horror film called Army of the Dead, which we know very little about.
That's a good thing, because his best film was a horror film.
And then what I think are two big pieces of news, whether they're good or not, is up for debate. I guess a week ago or so, it was revealed that they're going to be rebooting Ghostbusters with a sequel to the original series, pretending the all-female-led Ghostbusters film from a couple of years ago never happened.
Yeah, the reboot didn't happen.
And it's being directed by Jason Reitman, who is the son of Ivan Reitman and has had some success as a director himself. All that's released is a teaser. It will be out in 2020. Whether you're looking forward to it or whether you're groaning about it like Eric Webster apparently is, it's certainly news. And the other one is that Universal is finally doing what pretty much everybody that's a horror fan said they should have done in the first place, which is they are rebooting their Dark Universe series, starting with The Invisible Man.
And guess who's directing it?
And speaking of Upgrade, right, the director is Phil?
Lee Whannell.
Right, of Insidious.
Going to be awesome.
Was he Insidious 3 or Insidious 4?
He directed Insidious 3. He wrote all the Insidiouses, pretty much, except for 2, I think. He wrote the first, and he wrote the fourth, and he wrote... and he directed the third.
And he did direct Upgrade, which was a hell of a film, whether or not...
And he wrote it as well.
So, yeah,
and
I mean, that's...
By the way, he did a commentary on it, which is freaking hilarious.
Oh, really?
On
Upgrade, his commentary is hilarious.
It's only on the iTunes release. You can't get it on the disc. It's not an extra on the disc. It's an extra on the iTunes VOD purchase.
I didn't realize it was an exclusive.
Yep. Yeah, it's a bare bones disc, which is one of the reasons I haven't picked it up yet.
I would make the same choice.
Yeah, I picked it up, but I now wish I just got the iTunes because of the extra.
So no word on who's going to be attached as a star, but they're basically saying the monsters are the stars, which again is what they should have always done. They will be low budget films. They will not be, maybe they won't be, you know, Paranormal Activity low budget, but they will be your typical Blumhouse, probably $20 million and under. I can't imagine, unless the star is willing to do it just for points, meaning a percentage on the back end as opposed to an upright fee. Now, you do have a lot of the actors they had signed on before, like Johnny Depp and whatnot, that I think there's contractual issues that they're going to have options to be in these, but they're probably going to pass on them since they're not going to meet their salary demands.
Right. And the thing is that they should be $30 million or less, because these should be more like haunted house films rather than these super action, you know, Hollywood crapola fests, in my opinion. Before we begin, co-host Abe has joined us. How are you, Abe?
Sorry.
Hey,
Hollywood crapola
fests. Hi, how you doing there, guys?
Well, we're doing well. Also, Mike, there's a new... teaser trailer for Suicide Squad 2?
Yeah, really weird one. It just shows some, looks like costume tests of some of the characters. I don't know why they released it now. It's like no story.
It's called a teaser, that's what they call
it. Yeah, well, it's not even, it's a teaser of a teaser. It's barely anything substantial. It's just some flashes of images that they took from what looks like behind the scenes stuff. So, and no actual footage from the film.
Right. So I'll be curious to see how that goes. But we get to see the same characters that we've come to love. The Criterion channel has been announced. I guess this replaces the one that folded, Mike. They're offering Charter subscriptions to anybody who wants to. So you'll get a discount. It's CriterionChannel.com. And I assume it'll probably just be the same as before, Mike, except now they're actually using how they should have marketed it before, which is their name instead of whatever it was called before.
Well, here's the problem. I don't want to poo-poo this because I didn't take advantage of the last service, which was Filmstruck. All the Criterion channels had previously been available on Hulu for quote-unquote free, right? Your typical subscribe to Hulu, you got all the Criterion titles. Criterion decides, or whoever runs Criterion, someone decides, we're going to take all those titles, we're going to put them in our own service aimed at classic film buffs or what have you, and it was called Filmstruck. And Filmstruck didn't last 2 years. And many people in the industry got upset, some of them a little overblown, saying, "This, how are we going to save these films?" Well, the films exist on disc. They exist, many of them, in the National Archives. They're saved. It just was one outlet for people to see them. And Criterion could do whatever it wanted with those things, but nobody was willing to pony up, I think it was like $12 a month, or not many people, to watch these classic films. And now, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but on the surface, it looks like, wait, we got a new idea. What's the new idea? The same as the old idea, with a new name. And I don't know if that's going to really drag that many people into it. I don't know if the market for the streaming audience that they need to really compete at, I think it's now $11 a month instead of $12 a month, which is more than you're paying for Netflix, is, I mean, if they were doing this as $5 a month, like Shudder, they might have a better opportunity here. I don't know. I don't see how this is substantially different than what they did before with Filmstruck.
Well, and I was honestly not familiar with Filmstruck or that they were doing any of these things, but I think I've said this on this podcast before. There's so much streaming that's coming out now that eventually this whole thing is going to collapse because people are going to be like, okay, I got out of cable for $120 a month, but now I pay X for Netflix, X for a sports thing, X for Disney, X for, I don't know, Filmtastic or whatever the hell. And and sooner or later, somebody's going to sit down or everybody's going to start sitting down and going, well, holy shit, I'm not paying $120 a month for cable, but now I have 10 different things and it's like $115 or $100. It's the same as I was paying for cable, but I only have access to 12 things. And you know what I'm saying? It's just, I just don't know. I don't know.
That's the thing with anime as well. Certain shows get taken by certain streaming services and they're only being made available through the streaming services. So if you see a show you want to watch, you unfortunately have to subscribe to that service. And it becomes a problem because you just like every single kind of service is grabbing something that you might watch that is maybe more or expensive and stuff like that.
But at the same time, it's like... It's just like what we used to do with network TV when it was free. You make a choice. You choose what to watch.
Right. Yeah,
but the problem is, it's just like the very fact that if you want to see one certain story I want to watch, I got to go for a certain streaming service.
That's what I think they mean, Eric.
Yeah,
I get it. I'm just saying don't. That's
right,
all.
Right, right. Even if you do want to see Ozark, but you're already paying
I would love to watch the
things.
New Star Trek series, but I'm not going to sign up for another goddamn streaming service, so I don't watch it.
Right, and that's the unfortunate thing is that because it's not like the old networks, because if you didn't want to watch what was on CBS, you didn't watch what was on CBS, but when it was on CBS, it cost you nothing to turn the channel.
Yeah. Right?
You know, so you could flip over that way. Now, you can get to like HBO, Showtime, Cinemax, Stars, and the pay channels, but until recently, most of those weren't offering a great deal of original content. And so if you want to watch the movie, you could buy it on Amazon, you know, the disc, or rent the VHS at Blockbuster. There is no option for CBS All Access, right, to say, if you want to watch the new Star Trek, you can pay a one-time $5 fee, stream the entire series, and then you're done with that. Nope, you have to subscribe. You get a free 30-day window, but as we know, they're all counting on people to forget to unsubscribe on that free 30-day window because it said, sure, it's free. What's your credit card number?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not Filmstruck, because the Criterion is doing the same thing. It'll be free. If you sign up now, it'll be free for the first 30 days. And then
I don't find myself feeling like I'm being deprived of content.
I don't either. I just find it sad that...
You can't get to see everything you want to see.
You never could get to see everything you want to see.
You had more access, but there's so much more out there now. I think it's more that I see it as this is unsustainable, and you're going to see more of these. Either you're going to see more of them joining forces, or they're going to collapse. I think, like I said,
I'll agree with that. Yeah,
if you're Shudder, right? I'll pay for Shudder. It's $5. If you're Shudder, $5 a month seems to me like even it is as stupid as it sounds. I think there's more people out there, and it could just be me, that would be willing to pay for three $5 subscriptions a month than one $10 subscription. If that makes any sense. It's just, I think, a psychological thing, and it's just sort of how the dollar stores were born, right? With the dollar stores, they found that if they marked something down to a dollar, people would buy a lot of it. If they took the same thing and marked it as 50 cents, and they didn't sell as many as if they just did two for a dollar, even though the price was exactly the same. There's something psychological about the dollar there. And I think at the dollar value, people were more likely to sign to buy it. I think that here, I think the psychological problem is I don't know that people are going to want to spend a whole lot on $10 services.
All right.
Anyhow, it's a price barrier. Whatever.
Okay.
Abe, I saw that you posted on the Facebook group that makeup artist Matt Rose passed away of Hellboy fame and Beetlejuice fame.
It's just unfortunate, another unfortunate passing. You know, we've been having a lot of those these last few years, and it's just sad to see another creative force leaving us.
Yeah, he actually did a lot of stuff too, because he did part of Fright Night, he did Star Trek Beyond. How the Grinch Stole Christmas, part of the Planet of the Apes remakes, Predator, and so on. So he was pretty prolific.
Oh, yeah, very.
Yeah, so rest in peace there. All right, I guess we can get into our topic for tonight. So, Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we are talking about and why we're talking about it?
All right. Well, we're doing a Patreon pick tonight. It was actually drawn, wasn't it 2 quarters ago, Phil?
Yes.
It was sometime in 2018, maybe July. And we had a little bit of issue getting a hold of the movie because it's got a Criterion release. And apparently the deal now is when that happens, the only way you can get it for a while is on disc. So I sucked it up and I bought the Criterion Blu-ray, which is a very nice package and presentation of the movie. Even though it's a movie I wasn't particularly interested in owning, I can speak to the quality of the Criterion release. And some other people took a different route. Anyway, we all watched the movie, and we're going to talk about it tonight. And the movie in question is 1971's Straw Dogs, starring Dustin Hoffman.
Fun. I'll give you one more chance. And if you don't clear out now, there'll be real trouble. I mean it.
This is David Sumner. All his life, he's been running away, turning his back on trouble, involvement, and confrontation. Until now.
There are 5 men out there.
I know that.
He took his wife and fled to an English country town.
There was once a time, Mrs. Sumner, when you were ready to beg me for it.
Take your hands off me.
What are you doing? You're an animal.
He thought he could find peace and refuge. Instead, he found that a man can't hide forever.
I care. This is where I live.
No!
I will not allow violence against this house.
Sam Peckinpah, who uncaged the Wild Bunch, now unleashes Dustin Hoffman in Straw Dogs.
That's right, Straw Dogs, starring Dustin Hoffman as well as Susan George, directed by what some Hollywood folk or critical people, I should say, state is one of the best directors of all time, named Sam Peckinpah. Though oddly, both he and Susan George, even though they were both huge during their heyday, neither of them have many titles in their list that younger folk would know, which is kind of interesting, even though one, Susan George was pretty big back in the 70s and 80s and late 60s and Peckinpah for his renown. The film is 48 years old, which is amazing to think that. We won't discuss the cloud that is around Dustin Hoffman now in his career and what's happened. So we just wanted to have that in passing. So if anybody emails to say why we didn't, I don't think it's necessary if people want to learn.
There really isn't a big cloud right now.
We're talking about the movie, not the person.
Yeah.
Yes, but I'm doing this for email's sake.
No, I get it.
If people have issues about Dustin Hoffman, we understand, and this is just for the movie itself and has nothing to do with the personal lives of the people. So let's get into how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. Let's start with you, Eric.
I heard about this movie. I can't remember how I first heard about it, to be honest. I had seen it before, and didn't really care for it. But I didn't remember much about it. So I was glad I had the opportunity to rewatch it. I can't say I enjoyed watching this movie. I don't find it to be a very pleasant experience to view this movie. There is some skill involved in the making of the movie, but I generally found all the characters to be unlikable. So it was a bit of an issue for me sitting through the movie, and I'll get into details as to why I didn't like them, later on. So, I understand why this is considered a film of note. I understand controversy around it. And it's not my cup of tea personally, but I can understand why some people would be into it. Not for me personally. But it might be for some people.
All right. Sounds good. I'll go next. A couple other things. Daniel Melnick, the head of, I think, MGM Studios, was the producer of this film, and he's well known. People have heard of him. He has 20 Academy Awards and 80 nominations in his career. The film was co-written by Dave Zelig Goldman, who people also may know from Logan's Run, and he co-wrote The Eyes of Laura Mars with John Carpenter. I actually saw parts of this film twice when I was a little kid, because it was running as reruns on the local VHS or UHF or whatever.
Did you watch it as a double feature with Taxi Driver?
I was going to say that the second time, one of the two times I watched parts of it was part of the Movie Loft with Dana Hershey, the same show that played Taxi Driver, and various other great films that I've found, including Poseidon Adventure and so forth. It was a once a week Friday night, I think, show, and this was one of them. But I didn't really pay attention to it much. It didn't really seem to interest me when I was a little kid. And then I decided to rewatch it about 7 years ago, 6 years ago, when I bought the Blu-ray. It was only like $8 or $9 by the MGM or whatever, the cheap disc with no real extras except the trailer. And when I watched it, I was kind of disappointed because I heard all the stuff about it, and I was a little like ho-hum and whatnot. But I was going to rewatch it for this episode, and I rewatched it last night, and I had an absolutely completely different experience. Unlike the first time I watched it, when I felt it dragged and it didn't really make sense to me when I first watched it, why he was in London, in Cornish and all that. But this time it didn't drag at all. The story really resonated with me. And I felt it was a fantastic film. This is a really, really good film. So I loved it. So yeah, big thumbs up for me. Mike.
Yeah, I watched it for the first time yesterday. I've actually owned the disc for a long, long time. I was going to watch it earlier, and because Pam was looking, my wife Pam was said, "Let's watch a movie." I said, "Okay, do you want to watch Straw Dogs?" She said, "What's it about?" I explained to her what the back of the box it was about. She said, "Oh, I already saw that." And so we didn't watch it that day, and I never got back around to watching it. So I watched it for this, so I was very glad that this was up there. This is a film, like a lot of films. First of all, it's nice that Dark Discussions gets back to what it does best, which is talking about rapey films. But these are the films that leave us uncomfortable, or at least leave me very uncomfortable. There's a lot to unpack here. I'm pretty sure this is my first Peckinpah film. He's a bit of a blind spot for me. Nothing, not that I've ever avoided it. I know I've wanted to watch The Wild Bunch for a long time, but just one I haven't caught up with. But he made a lot of Westerns, and that's not really my my forte. So I've missed a lot of his stuff. So this is my first experience with him, and I did more research on with him afterwards. And sounds like he could be a bit of an asshole. He was certainly a forceful personality. And some of that kind of comes through. He does things in here that I don't always think make much sense. There is one pivotal moment in the film that I'm curious to see what everybody else thinks involving the cat. I don't find any of the characters terribly likable, or at least any of the main characters. I think that might be part of the point. There is a very controversial rape scene in the film, and remember, this is in 1971, where not like rape has suddenly become widely accepted or anything, but it's less unusual to see a rape in a film. It feels like there's an entire subgenre of French horror movies built around that. But yeah, so I have very mixed feelings about the movie. It is a well-crafted film.
Oddly, Mike, since you had a pause there. You had a pause there, Mike. I wanted to bring up, 71 was also the year that A Clockwork Orange came out. So it was a strange year for violent films, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and this is in this weird in-between time where what we think of as 70s cinema is starting to come through. You know, the old Hays Code has gone away. The new rating systems are coming into place. And you haven't gone full blown into the 70s necessarily, or what we think of as a typical 70s film. So it has still has some elements sort of the filmmaking style of older films, but they're really also clearly starting to be comfortable pushing the edge. And there was some pushback to that. Yeah, no way this film would have gotten made 5 years earlier, I don't think. Right. Cause what was it? Psycho was 11 years earlier was and just showing a woman in her lingerie was considered risque.
Taboo, yeah.
Right, and even on TV, right? The Brady Bunch, the first time wife slept in the same bed.
Right, and here you have a really, I don't want to say interesting, because that really misleading. You have a rape scene that's an uncomfortable thing, but just a rape scene in general, and it's a controversial for reasons we'll discuss later. So I would recommend it with a lot of caution because of the type of film. It's a film that's uncomfortable to watch. I threw it out there on Reddit because I was curious what other people had said. There was one really good response. There were a couple of responses, but there was one that was really good. Zeke Curley, I think is how you pronounce his user tag. He says, "I think the film is showing the moral high ground slide back and forth, keeping us unsure of everything. The characters are inconsistent and unpredictable. To me, the very reason this film is important is that it is nasty and it is violent, and it does not take the time to consider whose fault what is. It is a series of reactions to bad situations, and most certainly a commentary on masculinity and escalation toward the end." And I think that's a good summation of it. Someone else also commented, "I watched this film when it first came out. It did not make a good date movie." I think that's also very true.
Jeez.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it says a lot of stuff about not just masculinity. Obviously, that's the most obvious, but it also talks about the reason they're there in the first place, because of the political problems on campuses, as well as I think it says something about the pompousness of the highbrow elites and the backwardsness of the rural town folk as well. So, and then it also has things about foreigners versus locals and all these other things too. So there's a lot this film packs besides the obvious male masculinity and what does that mean. So yeah, that's a interesting, some of the, what the Reddit folks said. All right. So, hey, what about yourself?
I knew about this film for a while, but I had not seen it until very recently. I watched it just not too long ago, keep it fresh to my mind, for this discussion. I went to this film pretty much mostly blind. And my first impressions was that, yeah, I definitely had to agree that much of the cast is very unlikable. I really had a hard time really becoming invested in any character. There was tension, but I don't know if I felt myself drawn to any character, and it says that not, you know, any of them being likable or nothing sort, but when, you know, bad things happen, it was very poignant. It was very powerful. The rape scene was a good example of that. And it's definitely one I could certainly see if it was shown to folks today would, you know, cause some debate and some anger and stuff like that. It's a very controversial scene, but it's not, as I said, we'll get into that. It's hard to really explain about going to spoils. And at times I felt the pacing was slow, but other times I felt it did really well of grabbing my attention because I had no idea where this was going. And I think the characters and the events are both chaotic. Everything there's no like clear pathway to where your character of choices and events, like, I don't say, it doesn't feel so much linear as it felt like one thing could trigger the other thing to, you know, escalate to something else. But it's a strong film, but not exactly one I would revisit personally. But it's a well shot film, well acted film. And it's definitely going to be a winner in the eyes of some viewers, but it's also going to be kind of one that could turn people off, and some for others may not exactly be their dish. But it's actually very interested in, you know, making sure I finish this movie so I can join the discussion, because there is a lot to break down here.
All right, very good. Chrissy.
Yeah, I saw this a couple of months ago, right after we did Deliverance, because my housemate Charles is kind of a film buff and has a library that would blow your mind.
Jesus, that's a 1-2 punch.
Yeah, and it literally was like the next day. He's like, well, we had so much fun drinking martinis and watching Deliverance. Let's make Manhattans and watch Straw Dogs. So that's literally what happens. And it's really great, though, because I am really starting to get in touch with a lot of classic, you know, and important 1970 cinema, because his collection is so awesome. And then, of course, I have someone who went and saw these in the theater to discuss all this with and remembers what the environment was like at the time and, you know, the criticism and what was being talked about and what the social issues were when the movie was released. So I'm really actually extremely lucky because I get a whole historical perspective on it that I wouldn't normally get. I did enjoy this movie. I was looking at it from, of course, a very critical perspective. I knew all about the rape going into it because Charles kind of prepared me for that, although he really didn't have to. But the way that he kind of prepared me for that was, you know, you have to remember that this movie was also released at the time when feminism was really like a big thing. So that kind of made it even worse than it normally would have been because of that particular social situation was going on. That was going on. I, of course, thought the acting was incredible. I loved the atmosphere in this movie. I do like that it is patterned like a Western. I think it is incredibly interesting to see the classic Western film story structure slapped into the middle of cold, dreary England. I just think there's such an interesting mashup there. And mashup is a terrible word, but I think everybody kind of knows what I mean. It's an interesting combination. Certainly, this movie has more to say in it than just about, you know, the obvious rape, like you guys said. There's a whole theme about mob mentality here. Which is certainly relevant to today, I think. There is a theme of provincialism. There is certainly a theme of idealism and the destruction of dreams. There's a lot in here about what happens when you reengage with your past, particularly when you return, or specifically when you go home again. You know that phrase, you can't go home again. And I think that that does play into that very controversial moment in the rape scene that everybody talks about that I won't spoil, but I'm pretty sure that's what that is connecting to. Any listeners out there that want to, I mean, as far as it can go and check out the criticism that's out there, there's loads of really good film criticism on this film. For me personally, I think it's a well-made film. It didn't necessarily make me as uncomfortable as I think it should have. But I'm often wondering if maybe that's because I'm female and also because I was prepped for it and because I had never seen it before and because I had a housemate that could really discuss the issues with me before I saw it. So, and honestly, I saw it, like I said, the night after I saw Deliverance. So the violence really was just like, oh, it's more of this. You know, you know what I mean? It was, I think when you do a double header like that, you kind of get desensitized. But I certainly would recommend it to anybody that really wants to see a very well-made film that is a fine example of 70s cinema that was important, that had something to say. This is not a movie that you watch for shits and giggles. This is a movie you watch if you want to get serious. Yeah, and you want your brain to chew on something. If you want to think, this is the movie you need to get. So,
film brain.
All right, I'll shut up now.
Right. Well, and you know, it's curious that it is a thinking person's film, and yet I could see many people just watching it for the over-top violence and whatnot, because
I wouldn't even call the violence that over the top, though. It's actually, I was actually surprised how, you know, considering sometimes in the 1970s, there were some pretty vicious films, but in comparison to some of those that were released, this is rather tame.
Well, what films are you thinking of?
I was thinking more like the Italian zombie films and stuff like that.
Yeah, but most
we're talking
are
about
later
Hollywood
in the 70s.
Films. Yeah, and we're talking about the Hollywood films is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is I wouldn't really call this over the top in comparison.
I'm saying for the time, for 1971, right, Clockwork Orange, you had that also with Kubrick. So you had Kubrick and you had Peckinpah, who were both A-list directors.
William Friedkin, French Connection was the same year as well.
Yeah, but that wasn't maybe I'm misremembering, but I don't remember it being brutal in the same way.
Yeah, all right, that's fair.
Clockwork Orange was more unsettling, but I wouldn't say it also had its own rape scene that was pretty shocking for the time.
Right, I'm saying if you compare this more to the films of the late 60s when this is coming out of that era, this is one of the things that set up the mold to allow, right, you know, later films in the 70s to do it.
Right, right? And also there's a difference between 42nd Street films that only had a limited audience versus, and probably were unrated versus these type of films that were actually at major theaters in, you know, in suburbanite towns.
Yeah, in terms of just in horror terms, it's a year before Last House on the Left, 2 years before The Exorcist, and 3 years before Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So, and those films, I don't think are anywhere, well, maybe Last House on the Left, but I don't think most of those films are anywhere near, really, when you get down to it, because they don't have that rape scene. I don't think they quite touch on this one as much, but they certainly helped pave the way for that. And all of those were met with controversy when they were released.
Right, right. And unlike those films, this film was at major cinemas. You know, all the other three that you mentioned, Mike, were mostly 42nd Street cinemas, you know, Grindhouse cinemas or whatever, or drive-ins, you know.
Right.
All right, so that's good. Eric, I guess the wiki, right?
Wiki. All right. A young American and his English wife come to rural England and face increasingly vicious local harassment.
It's very basic, but it's kind of, I think for a description, it allows you kind of get into it without knowing too much, because it kind of helps the experience.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's true. And that's a fairly vague setup, because, it, you know, I mean, it's a little obviously more convoluted how it all happens.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Why it happens.
That's what I meant. It was not exactly a linear way of setting things up, because you think one thing's going to trigger the climax, but something else does.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. Yeah, absolutely. A few things you think are going to cause a violent reaction by the end of the film, and it had nothing to do with it, which is kind of humorous. And that's because of the main character and his, I guess, losses. A lot of people say the masculinity thing, but I look at it as more of a self-respect.
Well, you know how I look at it, Phil? I have this philosophy. I don't know if I've ever talked about it on the podcast before, but I've generally come to the conclusion that people suck.
Yes.
And this movie is kind of a shining example of that.
Right, right. Well, and it also shows even when nothing is happening, the people are doing stupid things. For example, when you have something happen where an animal is murdered, usually you would go to the police department and there's, you know, they instead, let's do it ourselves. And then when they are about to do it themselves to confront people they think may have caused it, they don't. And then and
everybody in this movie is awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, can we just talk about the couple for
okay.
a second?
Well, are we going to throw
actually,
up a spoiler flag?
Yeah. Throw the spoiler
yeah.
out.
All right.
Before
spoiler Mike, flag is up, listeners.
Before you say anything, I just would like to state this because I am the girl on this podcast. So I'm just going to say this now so that if the guys make reference to this, they do not get in trouble, because I totally agree with them. This girl's a bitch.
Yeah.
I cannot fucking stand her. And to be honest with you, I did not feel bad for her when she was getting raped. I did
wow.
not. I was like, I didn't. I was like, you know what? You're a bitch.
Okay.
You're a bitch.
I have my thoughts about the character, and I would disagree. Because...
No, I am not. No, wait a minute. I'm not saying that she deserved it all. That is not what I'm saying. There is a distinction here. No one deserves that. I am saying I had trouble feeling bad for her.
No,
that's
no,
what I'm saying.
I know, yeah. but I overlooked that comment anyway. I'm talking about her as a despicable character or not. And up to a point, I didn't feel that way. It was at a certain point in the film is when I determined that she was a despicable character. But prior to that, she didn't seem it. Go on, Eric.
I was just going to say, perhaps part of the reason that Chrissy didn't have much
remorse.
Sympathy for her.
Yeah,
while
that's,
she was
that's
in a rape scene is because of the way the rape scene was shot, and that's part of the controversy surrounding this movie. So do you want to jump in and talk about it now, or do you
want
to try and do
the
chronological order, or
what?
Can we talk about the leads first and their relationship?
Yeah.
And definitely definitely want to get to the rape scene.
There's no reason to bring that scene up until we explain why it happens and what goes on. And before Abe, you speak, let Mike discuss that because he's been trying to get into it.
Abe, what were you going
to
say?
I was going to say, I think it's important to get understand and break down the rape scene. Well, I think we do have to understand the relationship between the characters, our leads, as well as the set of the circumstances.
And also the characters and how they know the characters that participated in the rape also, because that's very important as well. But, all right, go on, Mike.
Yeah, so I'm with Chrissy. I didn't like either one of them terribly. I can, and maybe it's coming as a male, I could identify more with, was it Dan? David?
David.
David, David's character?
David,
which
yeah.
Is Dan, Hoffman played a guy named David Sumner, and Susan George plays his wife, Amy Sumner.
Right, so I can identify more with David, it might be just as a guy. Okay? He's trying to get his work done, and he can't get his work done because his wife and the cat and everything else keeps creating distractions. I think anyone who has a job can certainly identify with that, right?
I still have issues with all that too, because
you don't identify with that at all.
Not in this circumstance, because there's a lot of times where he had plenty of time and was working fine, and they didn't show her being annoying enough. In this case, when she's asking of something about the cat or do you want lunch, I wouldn't consider those things annoying.
Well, a lot of this is very small jabs throughout. It's a lot of polite barbs through smiling faces is what I felt. And I'm not, and I also want to say I'm not necessarily excusing him either. I'm just saying I can identify with it a little better. But there's a lot of passive aggressive behavior between them.
Oh, right.
That he is obviously really annoyed with her at times because she's preventing getting to work. She's there. She's bored out of her mind. This is why they had to invent cell phones. You know, she's got nothing to do. She's making comments like he says something like, "Is that your father's chair?" And she says, "Well, they're all my father's chair because it's your family homestead." So it's this little reminders cutting down, because we talk about the masculinity. It's sort of cutting into his masculine sense of worth again. Remember, this is 1971, and you know she like there's the comment where David Warner is an uncredited performance for political like behind the scenes reasons. He didn't get credit in the film. Playing, I guess, a pedophile.
No, playing a man that is slow.
And
I don't think he is a pedophile. I think
I
think that was made up by the town folk who.
Well, who is perceived as a pedophile in the book this is based on, he is definitely a pedophile. It's alluded, and certainly there's a belief of that in the towns. Anyway, there's a scene early on where he makes a comment at Amy, about how immature she's acting, and she keeps acting more and more immature. And it's something like, you know, you want to act like an 8-year-old. She starts acting like an 8-year-old, and it's like, oh, now you're really getting me going. And I was like, well, that was getting a little creepy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, I don't, as someone who defended James Gunn making jokes about that, that's fine. But within the context of the larger film, you know, there really is nothing between these characters outside of a physical relationship.
Are you talking about the husband and wife?
The husband and wife.
Okay.
If I could interject for a second, Mike, basically what it is he's appears to be some sort of professor or an adjunct professor at a college, and she happened to be a student there at one point. They married. She seemed to be a liberal progressive type on campus, while he was he didn't really care about that stuff. His interest was science and mathematics and that type of and theory work.
And there's little things, hints in the film about opposites. I don't know if you caught some of them. whether it was her changing the plus sign to a minus, they had the magnets repelling each other.
Right. And then you know, he's kind of an ugly dorky guy, and she's, you know, a gorgeous hip girl. So that's most certainly the type of two people that probably wouldn't have got together, especially
right.
based off of their things that they do, which is she's politics and he's into mathematics.
Well, that repellent is part of the thing of conflict within here. Not all, I mean, people in this film can't really see eye to eye in any way or come to any agreement
right.
or peace. You know, if you know, the husband and wife can't get to see eye to eye, the townspeople can't see eye to eye. The foreigner can't see eye to eye with the people he's living with, and so on and so forth. And all this crazy is the recipe for this fucking shitstorm that starts to erupt.
Well, and I'd like to make a couple comments on the married couple, if I may. The first is that I found Dustin Hoffman's character to be pretty sexist at points.
He's a douchebag, no doubt.
Yeah, there's one point when they're in town when somebody asks the wife what he does, and she starts to tell him, and he's just like, ha ha ha, nice try, trying to understand what I do, honey. You couldn't possibly understand.
Yeah.
It's just like, come on. You know, and then there's a point later on when he says something about the cat answering her call, and she goes, like, I do to you, and he's like, well, you'd better. It's like, come on, man, really?
Yeah, well, in the numerous moments where he's like, I tell you and stuff like that.
I thought she had said the cat won't come on a call. I thought she had said, I don't either.
Well, maybe, but the point is that he was like, yeah, you'd better, like, you're mine, and you better do what I say.
Well, it's also he's just a prick because, okay, fine, the cat, she loves more than him, and it's her cat probably and not his, but you would think if he was not a dink, when she has concern about her pet, he would have sympathy for her rather than
right.
saying,
well,
I don't care.
Yeah,
right,
I think
there's also that scene later that we'll get to.
Yeah,
let me finish up my thoughts on both of them here, because my particular thought on the wife is that she's as Chrissy said, a bitch, and I think the biggest thing with her character is that when we're seeing these petty little arguments at the beginning, the one that seems to be serious, I kind of like the way they left it vague and didn't give it any specific events to refer to. But she's yelling at him about how he never will take a stand and how they ran away from America to come here because he wouldn't take a stand and he was afraid of everything. And then later in the movie, he finally does take a stand, and she won't stand by him when he does. So it's like, what is your fucking deal, woman?
Yeah, it's one of those
things. It's almost like a control thing, but go on.
Yeah, it's definitely that case here. I think it just shows also the chaotic way that life and how, you know, this is taking place in a very small town. The point I'm trying to say is that ideals and the way we expect things to go in our lives and what we expect from others don't really go the way as we can sometimes with hope, you know? I mean, she has this idea that he'll always be, you know, at her side and doing what she wants, and he has the same expectation of her to leave him alone and doing things like that. And, you know, this little idea of this new beginning, you know, none of them were ready for it. They were clearly never ready for marriage either, or at least for what they expected of each other. And I think this also kind of helped set the building blocks to reveal that they how more little they know about each other by the end of the film.
Well, I mean, and my point too was, because all I've said so far about this film and these two characters is that this woman's a bitch, so I did want to say something else. I think not only are they clearly opposites, I almost get the sense that they were the only ones who would really have each other. There's a couple of references in this film to the idea. You kind of get the sense that she left this town for a reason, They never really reference it. They never really go into it. But like
Podunk Town, that's why.
Yeah, but she didn't fit there. And like the line that Eric said, yes, I agree. The Dustin Hoffman character of David is sexist, and he's sexist in that very typical like 70s kind of asshole way. But I do agree with you, Phil. I also think he is just an asshole. And probably narc, because there are a few things in there that he does that are very narc.
Narcissist personality disorder.
Yeah, where he like stonewalls her. That's what the whole cat thing is about. He's just stonewalling her. He has no empathy at all, because it's almost like a borderline
sociopath.
It's sociopath. Yeah, they have no empathy or sympathy for anyone. But that line where he says, oh, like, you can't explain what I do. See, I almost took that to mean, Eric, like, she was not his intellectual equal. And I kind of got the sense that she wasn't. So I didn't take that particular remark as sexist. I kind of found them an unequal yoke in another way. Not only are they sexually unequal, but they're also intellectually unequal.
Well, the intellectual... I mean, she's still a college graduate, so she's not necessarily stupid. It's just that he happens to be an elite mathematician that can get a grant. So obviously, if you're, Bill Gates, your wife isn't necessarily ever going to be as smart as you, no matter how hard you look. You know, just as if you are a famous model, the chance you're going to find someone as equal as looking as good as you, you know, you see what I'm saying. So it's like,
right. I do. But this is also too, Phil. It also is the '70s. And this was still just like we said, early feminism. There were still lots of women at that time who were not going to college. And some women who did go to college, in all honesty, were not there to actually get an education. It was called the MRS degree. You went to find a guy to marry, and there that was still very much.
What's MRS stand for?
Mrs.
Gotcha.
In other words, they're there looking for husbands.
Yeah, no, I understand. I just need to know what MRS.
I know, but that was still. But I mean, that's a joke. That's still a joke that goes on today. But that was very prevalent at the time. Is that and. Being so distanced from it, because it's now, what, 40-something years later, we tend to forget that the world was still different. 48 years later. Right, because I was born in 71. Duh, idiot. And my birthday is actually Tuesday. But my point is just that the world was different, and maybe she wasn't one of those ones who went to college to get an education.
Well, tell you
maybe
what, though,
she went to go find a husband, and that's it.
There's a scene in the movie... And I hadn't seen it in a long time and didn't remember much, but when I did my watch this week, there's a scene where she goes into his study where he's doing all his work, and like Mike referenced earlier, she erases the plus sign and replaces it with a minus sign. And for a second, I was like, oh, wait a minute. Is she correcting his work? That would be awesome. But no, she was just being a bitch.
Right. I
thought it would have been a lot more interesting if she was actually smarter than him and correcting his work behind his back.
But it was right after a fight, though, right? So it wasn't like she just did it for the hell of it.
Well, it was after a spat, but it's also there's certain now. Well, first of all, she does that later on in the film. Now, if you're on your ball, you should be able to catch that. Later on in the film, doesn't she erase like half the board that he's working on?
Yes,
and that's a lot harder. You're fucking around with his career when you're doing that. Even whenever
I sympathize with her the whole first half of the film because he was a prick, and this was her way to get revenge on him. He did an action, and what she does is a reaction to his actions. If he wasn't a dink, she wouldn't have done that.
And she's a bitch. It's I'm saying they're both terrible people who deserve each other.
Yeah,
I'll agree with you on that. But
you know, I'm not trying to defend. Like I identified a bit more with him but only because I could put myself more easily in his place. She's there. She's bored. She's got nothing to do except fiddle around the house. She's not even – and, again, this is going to sound sexist, but she's not even keeping house. This is 1971. It's still early in the women's lib movement. So some of the stuff that you could see as sexist I could take as, well, it's 1971, but not all of it. you know.
See, actually, I didn't see any of this. I saw all that stuff. I didn't get it all. I got that he was just a dink because when he came to town, he was rude to all the locals, even the locals that weren't dinks, he was kind of rude to. He was a dink to her. He let these bozos work on the house when he could have just fired them and got good people. And she was just pissed at all this stuff. And that's what I felt. So I completely.
Well, again, part of it is that he's a beta male for much of it, right? He's a guy who's not standing up for himself. He's letting himself be pushed around by basically his employees, by these guys that both of them look down on overall. And at the same time, when she's making comments about these people, you know, she's also then turning around and walking past the window with her top off and making sure everyone sees her tits. And she's being a tease. You know, he talks about, and I know a lot of people say,
that was a reaction to him being a dink again.
Yeah, but she had just been complaining about people looking at her, and he said, well, maybe you should be wearing a bra around these people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the other issue too is that the things that she does, Phil, to him, yes, he's being a jerk, and I totally agree with you, he's an asshole. But she's literally playing with fire.
Yes.
That was the other thing that I had a problem with that made me very unsympathetic to her. I sat there and went, well, you're a fucking psycho. Okay, so you're not paying any bills. You're not working. You're not making any money, which means you are reliant on your – wait, let me finish – on your husband's income. So therefore – what kind of a fucking asshole are you to go into his office when he is doing important work and there is a thing where they say, you know, that he needs to do this because his job's on the line, and she's going to go mess with his work? And okay, so then you're going to have to go to work, bitch. How stupid are you?
All right, well,
if he loses his job, you're screwed.
I'll tell you a couple things. First of all, they got a whole year. He has a whole year to do it, and he got paid to do it, so fine. But second, she gave up everything to allow him to use her house on her property. So I don't.
What
think
did she give up?
Yeah,
she gave up her life in America. She didn't want to come back. She said it numerous times at the beginning of the film that she's here because this is what he wanted to go to.
Right, but
she wanted to leave the campus.
Did she have some sort of, but we never get a hint at like that she had a career or other opportunities. It was a matter of just where she was comfortable, not, you know, a matter of she gave up, you know.
Well, that may be true that may be true that we don't know enough background of what they were doing in the States, but she gave up everything and he basically agrees to come to Cornish so he can do his work. So you have two people who are I guess, professionals, you know, college graduates, where one is giving up their life to help the other do something, and he isn't appreciative of it because he's thinking, I guess, similar to what you said, Carrie, which, I mean, like, Carrie, Christy, I work with Carrie at work, Christy, which is that, you know, she's doing nothing, but I think she's given up probably more than what you're giving her credit for.
Well, she does, but she doesn't show us anything that implies that she really had anything.
Yeah, that's my problem.
And if there was more, then the writer at some point should have hinted at this. I think an interesting story change from the novel, and there's a couple of them, but for this part of the conversation, is that in the novel she has they have a daughter. First of all, in the novel, he's an English professor, number one. Second of all, they have a daughter. And by getting rid of the daughter, they get rid of the daughter and basically play her younger and more immature, which has been harder to pull off if they had been married long enough to have, I think it was like an 8-year-old daughter. So this is one thing that they do in the film, I think, to help create more of a wedge between them. And I really want to get to what does everyone think happened to the cat?
I honestly think one of the workers killed it.
Yeah, of course. Oh, why? What do you think, Mike? I mean, because I think everybody thinks it's the workers.
I think that earlier in the film, the cat's on the table and he's throwing fruit at it. Mm-hmm. Then, now, I can say...
Oh, that makes sense, Mike.
I could say that he's sitting in the bedroom. If I'm sitting in the bedroom, my wife opens the closet door and screams her head off, which is what happened.
No. That was after he looked. He found it.
She found it. She's the one who discovered it.
No, he found it.
He found it first, Mike.
Yes, he did.
Oh, did he?
Yeah,
and then he didn't fucking tell her she saw his reaction and said, what's wrong? And he didn't tell her.
But,
he made her go over to the closet and look.
It wouldn't surprise me if he did it.
Oh, no. I mean, I could honestly see a guy
It makes sense, and I'll say why it could make sense. A couple of reasons. One, as Chrissy said, you know, he could be a sociopath. He's an uncaring prick. But the main thing is he's chicken to confront the people, because she says confront them and tell them, you know, and he goes, all right, I'll ask them later. And then he finally says, all right, fine, I'll do it now. And then he never does, probably because he knows they didn't do it because he did it. So that makes sense.
We know he doesn't like the cat. The cat, he claims, or the cat or the chasing after the cat was keeping him from doing his work.
Right. His reaction when he opened the closet seemed genuine, so I don't think it was him.
All right. Sure. I'll have to go back and double check.
I felt that way too.
I honestly think that he is chicken too. He is chicken shit, but I don't think he killed the cat. I mean, it would surprise me if he did, but...
It's a good theory, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. I
kind of had the thought that, honestly, my thought was if it wasn't him, then she freaking did it to get attention.
No, because
that's how much I did not stand. I could not stand her.
No. The best was when he says, "Well, maybe it was a homeless person that came in and did it." And she goes, "And she," it's like she says, "You know damn well that's not true. It was one of those scumbags out there that did it."
Well, because nobody else is around.
Yeah.
And so. What he should have done was go to the cops and say, or she should have gone to the cops, or they should have agreed, let's go to the cop, because someone obviously came into our house and killed our cat, whether or not it's one of those four scumbags, even though they're the obvious people that probably did it.
Nobody in this movie is a reasonable person, so that didn't
happen. And so that's what I mean by the fact that there's no real communication to the point that every person is a bit of fuel to a growing fire. You know, there's... You know, no one is capable of defusing it. They just continue to add more chaos to a mess. I mean, it's just one thing after another. It's escalation, you know? First we have an animal getting murdered, then we have a rape, then we have a manslaughter, then we have outright a home invasion fight.
Well, and the thing is that all this wouldn't have happened, even though the home invasion was just random luck or bad luck because he happened to... Hit the guy in the car. The whole thing before wouldn't happen if he just fired the people because they were incompetent assholes. And even if they weren't incompetent, they were pricks. So it's like, why do you want four people that are pricks working or incompetent working on your house? Just get up, fire them.
Well, the money might have been an issue. They are locals. One of them was a friend of hers.
Yeah, but if they're assholes and then they murder a cat, it's like just fire them.
But right, part of it is that the whole thing is set up is that he doesn't have the spine to stand up to them until he does. You know, and then again, when he does show the spine, you know, there's inconsistency in the characters, but those inconsistencies are very true to human nature. People are inconsistent. And I did watch the scene. Somehow I missed him catching the cat in the closet beforehand. So I completely retract it. I retract that completely.
Okay, fair enough.
But the
whole thing about, okay, I would confront them, which is stupid because you know these guys are loose cannon, so you should go to cops. But he's going to confront them. But instead of confronting him, they pretend they're his buddy, and they ask him to go hunting. And he's going, yeah, sure, that'd be fun. And it's like, doesn't he know that they both know that one of these four guys, or all four together, murdered the cat?
And well, he does it.
It's obvious who murdered the cat. I mean, we can't prove it. We can't prove OJ did it, but we all know he did it.
But denial can go a long way, Phil.
But again, it's his
people.
Wife.
People. 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 Well, who he doesn't have any respect for.
All right, could I? All right, let me just finish my point.
The ghost of OJ lives,
and then you can, then you can rip it apart all you want, or rationalize it differently. The point is the cat was killed. The obvious people that did it are the most likely to have done it, which are the four scumbags that work on the house. So he's going to confront them and say, "Who killed the cat?" But he chickens out, and they say, "Hey, why don't you come hunting with us?" And he knows that his wife is devastated, and his wife is the one that wants him to confront these guys, or at least do something about it. And instead, he basically takes a poker from the fireplace and puts it in her eye by saying, "Yeah, I'll go hunting with you guys." I mean, that's a fucking scummy thing to do.
I don't know if I'd put it on that level.
Dude,
I could understand if she was upset about it, but...
Dude, if you were married to someone and your cat was killed, and your wife says, "I'm going to confront the neighbor because we know the neighbor probably did it," and then she says, "Oh, you know what? I went over there, but instead we're going out to dinner," you would be pissed.
Well, you're skipping over part of that whole sequence of events, which is her thing with the bowl of milk.
That was a good shot at him.
Okay. Phil's clearly drawing sides here.
Yeah, she's hot, so she's right no matter what.
No,
she flashes. We have
four people. We have four people who we know by the end of the movie are pure evil, and at this point,
no, we don't.
Probably. Oh, Jesus Christ! And at this point, we know that they're the most likely suspects to have killed the cat, and then he goes off and hangs out with them. When first of all, they've been treating him like shit and her the whole time, and then there's a death of a beloved family animal, which they probably killed.
Beloved to who?
All right, forget it. I'm done. Okay, forget it. Well, I have no more
point. It's beloved by her, not by him.
And he's supposed to love her, so you would think he would take her side.
But again, they have a shitty relationship. This is what we've been saying all along.
Well, and part of the stress in their relationship is the fact that he has no spine.
No.
And this is part of the problem, because he won't confront them. And that's exactly what she was yelling about him before, is that he never takes a stand.
And
this is another example of that aspect of his personality, is that he will not confront them about this and goes hunting with them.
But here's the interesting twist. It's not the cat that finally gets him to do it, and he doesn't find out about what happens to his wife until very later. Towards the end of the movie, it's after they ditch him during the hunting that he actually fires them.
Well, that's also true. It's only until he's personally wronged.
Yep.
Right.
Which is bizarre, because you think he would be personally wronged the moment someone comes into his house and kills a cat.
Well, again, he can
rationalize. I agree.
You would think, but again, he's a shitty husband. And he can, to avoid confrontation, he can rationalize it, but we don't know who did it. And really, what the thing that's ironic about he falls for a snipe hunt, which is a fairly classic gag. You know, it's something that happens in a lot of places. Often, it's a bonding moment. It's a prank that guys pull on each other when they go hunting, and he overreacts to that instead of taking it in stride.
Well, yeah, it's also.
Well, I don't. I think he had the right to fire him. But anyway, go on, Eric.
Well, what am I trying to say? I'll give you an example. My father is a classical musician, and as such, he's led a bit of a sheltered life and not been exposed to a lot of things that many other people have been, like working an hourly job, for example, and things like that. He would have no experience with hunting or snipe hunts or whatever happens in those situations, and if it happened to him, it would be a complete surprise. And I think that's a similar situation here with this mathematician who suddenly gets brought out hunting. He would not be aware of snipe hunts, so I can understand how he'd get all pissed off about it.
I would agree with that, because he definitely, it's like Phil, like you said, you know, this is a guy who really doesn't have any clue, you know?
No. Absolutely.
He has no clue. He's completely out of his element. And this is one of those moments that ties into the theme of provincialism, you know, where provincialism, meaning, you know, he thinks that he knows everything in the world because he's such an elitist, you know, whatever, and I'm from America and I'm this big mathematician and I just know everything there is to know. But it's also provisionalism on the part of these people who live in this community, that their tiny world is all that they know and their tiny world is the best, and they can use their not their intimate knowledge of their lifestyle in order to trap and trick this man. And so it's kind of a comment on the dangers of provincialism, really, if you think about it. It's kind of a an off-the-cuff way of commenting on that, but it is interesting. It's different. You know, it's not big and deep. It's small, and if you don't pay attention, you miss it. But that's where it ties into the provincialism anyway. So.
And I think it's another interesting thing too is that it's when I'm and it, this entire village is almost is a small stage of everybody following their own rules and what they think is right. You know, we got some of the townsmen who think they're, you know, the vigilante mentality is the law. We got the only law enforcement man setting his rules. And of course, we have our main characters send their own rules of what things should be done, and none of them go the way they want them to go.
Yeah, but that, as you said, Abe, it just happens because of circumstance. Because the guy Warner's character happens to be in the house, but all the way up to that, those four guys plus the uncle have shown, obviously intentionally in the script, to be dinks, whether they act obnoxious at the bar, whether they possibly or most likely killed a cat, whether they laugh at everybody that does something that's unfortunate, and they, instead of saying, oh, gee, that's too bad, they just laugh. I mean, they're just like 15-year-old bullies that in 30-year-old bodies.
Well, yeah, but they have their own ideas of what, you know, they think is right. They think they have the right, for example, because of that man is Miles, I think his name is in the house, and he is the prime suspect. They have the right to do whatever they really want, instead of hand him over to the marshal. And as David, you know, sets his own rules of the house at the very end, because he thinks what he's right, and of course his wife has a different idea that they have no right to get involved, or they should not get involved.
Well, this is the thing, is that David is probably, even if he is a scumbag, he's 100% right at the end. He hit an individual, he brings him back home until the ambulance can come, because it's his responsibility. And then you have these vigilantes that come because of the missing Janice, who at this time we don't know has either been killed or has become unconscious. And they believe that the quote-unquote pedophile, because I didn't get that, but I guess the book said so, Mike.
And a lot of the summaries of the film, Will, if you look like on Wikipedia. I didn't pick it up just from watching the film, but that's what people seem to think.
Okay, yeah. So the guy, whether he's a pedophile or just mentally disturbed, you know, like George from Mice and Men, the point is that people want to get him for vigilante justice. And if these people were first of all, they're already questionable people, in my opinion, anyway, because of the way they've acted the whole movie. But at this point, when David says, well, we're going to wait, you guys wait, you know, just go and look for Janice. It's probably smarter if you try to find the girl. And then when the constable and the ambulance come to pick up Henry Niles, you know, then, you know, justice will be served. But they refuse because they're insane. They're in mob mentality, plus they're just bad people, in my opinion. And then they go crazy and they try to burn a house down and kill people and all these other stupid stuff. And it's like, it's just, so I honestly, I think David, even if he's a jerk, was 100% right at the end. You follow the law, your cops come and the ambulance come and that's that. And then you move on and then the five jerks can deal with whatever he did to Janice through the law. But
well, and that portion of the movie is also interesting because as I referenced earlier, that's when he finally is taking a stand. And at that point, his wife turns on him when up until then, she's been criticizing him for not taking a stand. So when he finally does the thing that she's been criticizing him for not doing, then she's no longer on board. And I found that to be a little weird.
Now, Eric, do you think the movie is trying to simplify it a little too easily? Because
I don't think there's anything simple about this movie.
No, there isn't.
Well, let me rephrase what I mean. Is that she wants him to take a stand, you know, fire these people or confront them about my cat. But when she's in what she thinks is she's in danger, even if because she knows these people and she knows them from her childhood and knows that they're unhinged. And one of them is an ex-criminal for that matter. She says, just give him the Niles guy. It's not our problem. Now, obviously that's bad because he sums it up. David sums it up perfectly, which is if we give him to these guys, he's dead.
Right.
And they're right. But she's also, I can see her point, even though I disagree with her 100%. But I see her point, which is, I know what these people are apt to do, and I don't want to be the person that's going to be their victim. And she'd already been raped by two of them, for Christ's sake.
Yes. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So she's like, just get them the fuck out of here. And so I felt it was simplifying masculinity too much because she, at one point she's saying, make a stand. And now when she is raped and also knows the danger that these people can do, she's the opposite, which is, you know, give in and just get rid of these people. And so I think it kind of simplified it a little too much, what message it was trying to say about masculinity because of that. But
yeah, that's fair enough. So let's circle back. We kind of went through the plot there, but jumped over the most controversial scene of the movie in the rape scene, which is between the hunting trip and the final scene that we were just talking about.
It was almost like they set him up to be stuck out in the forest because they leave him there and on purpose was because two of the men both not together. They both had the same thoughts, which is, well, I'm going to go back to the house and rape the girl.
Mm-hmm.
So,
was it clear to anybody else? Was it a setup? Did they intentionally get him away from the house to rape the wife?
I actually think it was what happened was, what was it?
Charlie?
No, yeah, Charlie wanted to get to her. And then suddenly the other asshole, Gus, gets involved because he holds Charlie at gunpoint.
But I also think they may not intentionally get him out there to rape the woman. I think they intentionally got him out there to purposely leave him there and make him look like an ass.
That's what a slave hunt is.
I get. I was wondering if the people that took the hunting trip knew what was going on at the house.
Scott had his own. The fact that Scott had to tell Werner to move aside to rape.
Well, that's the thing, Abe, is that I don't think the other two hunters knew that. So I think two people had no idea that the rape was going to occur, and they were just there to leave the guy in the woods and make him look like an ass. And the other two both felt that they were going back to rape the girl, but I think Werner went back not necessarily to rape her, but to try to hook up with her.
Right.
And then
the
other guy, Scott, he went there specifically to rape her because Werner and the Susan George character used to date when they were younger. So she didn't consider him a threatening person until at a certain point.
And I'm not even convinced entirely that Charlie raped her.
Well, let's talk about that. She said no.
She said no several times, but
this is the big controversy of this film, is that the way this rape scene was shot, at points, it seems like she might be into it.
Right.
It's really weird. There's points where she's pulling him towards her and opening her mouth to kiss him. And then she's, no, no, no. And then she'll pull him back. So it's like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
Well, there, you guys, when you're done talking, I'll give my 2 cents.
Yeah, because initially, when we get into that before that moment, those moments, you know, it's they're hitting each other, and then she's tearing off her clothes and stuff like that. But then as Eric mentioned, it just kind of shifts into this weird back and forth, you know, until Scott comes in here, where the tone is then put straight forward into, you know, like she's terrified and everything like that. So it's a really bizarre rape scene.
Right. I'm really want to be careful here because I only watched it the one time. I really don't have any desire to rewatch the rape scene. Part of it, you have to remember, this is a film made in, again, 1971, filmed by a man, written by a man, and some might not be coming at it from the most pro-female point of view. But there is sometimes where a bit of back and forth, a push and pull between men and women in intimate relationships. She's been flirting with him through the early part of the film. Whether it was innocent flirting or just teasing or whether she was serious is debatable, but they did have a relationship. And when he first comes to her and kisses her, she's in, like Eric said, she's into it. Then she pulls back and says, no, but is that, no, I don't really want to do this, or no, I shouldn't do this because she's married and it would be frowned upon.
I mean, let's be clear. It's a rape.
It's, well.
Yeah, I agree with
that. It's definitely a rape. Yeah.
But it's a weird rape.
It's a weird, well, because I don't know how much of her no was sincere in this particular instance. The way it was filmed and the way she was filmed, that they
well,
filmed reaction
I,
to it.
How about this, Mike? She did not want to do it, and she said no, and she wouldn't have done it if he didn't push it upon her. However, she has a relationship from him in the past where it is most apt that she probably had relations in the past and probably still has some sexual feelings for him in the past, that once it happened, and even though she was saying no, it appears that she was, like you said, it was this off and on thing throughout. But had he not pushed himself on her, she would in no way have had the relations with him.
Right. And well, if you want to go so far as to say that wasn't rape, which I personally would not go that route, it was a rape to me. The second part, that dude with the gun, is absolutely 100%
right.
without a doubt rape.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. And then when he comes in, that you can definitely tell from her response. She's no. She shouts no. She screams when he enters her. I guess if I read correctly, that it was his intention, which he got a little pushback from Susan George about, was that the second scene was going to be through the back door.
Right. I got that too. But my point, and also it was violent too. I mean, they're both violent, but there's two, as we know, there's many types of rape, unfortunately, that
right.
Where when you're passed out and drunk type of rape, and then there's the part where the woman is actually knows what's going on and is actually violently attacked. And the first one was one way, and the second one was purely a vicious attack, if that makes any sense. And again, a tough topic to talk about because it's rape is rape.
Can I say what I was going to say now?
Go ahead, Chris.
This is where I was talking about the comment of returning to the possible theme of the past and returning to from whence you came. You know, she says she didn't want to come back. She comes back and makes that sacrifice for him. Right. So now she's in this environment. And like I said, you get the sense there's a reason she left. Remember I said that earlier?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of was getting the idea that when he was raping her, and yes, it is rape,
okay,
that maybe part of the reason she had left this place initially was because she was heavily involved with this guy, and he was obviously abusive, possibly narcissistic, but when you're in a relationship with someone like that and the sex is violently amazing, that can create an addiction in the brain so that you are actually addicted to this. And so when I'm watching this from a completely different perspective than you guys, I'm sitting here going, this is probably the reason she left. And so this addiction is now returning. And so it's not now there could be another way this could go too. She's also frustrated with the fact through the whole movie, as you guys said, that her husband will not stand up for himself. Okay. So he's beta male. Here comes alpha male, incredibly hot to her, because what has she been complaining about the whole movie? My husband that I'm married to is not a man. Here comes this guy. Okay, he's abusive, he's violent, but he's familiar. I know him, and he is, you know, and I had to get out of here because he was probably going to do something to me, and I was going to get stuck here, you know, being married to this abusive person. But he's also incredibly masculine and forceful, where her husband is not.
And so he's hitting the primal buttons.
He is hitting all the primal buttons. And so that is what I got out of it, which is part of also why I maybe didn't feel that much sympathy for her. Because I kind of was keying into maybe none of this is there. Maybe none of this is there. Maybe it's not in her performance. Maybe the director didn't intend that. But me watching it, that's what I got out of it from my perspective. And so that's probably why, other than the fact that she was just a bitch and I couldn't stand her, I really didn't feel any sympathy for her. Because I'm like, here you are returning to something that you ran away from. And also, yeah, you're complaining, oh, I didn't want to come back, whatever. But if really it was that horrible, you would have just said, absolutely not. We are not going to my father's. Like, you know, she's still, even in the 70s, you know, there was a thing my dad used to say where he used to say, you know who really runs the White House, don't you? It's the woman. My dad always used to say that. And I think there is some truth in that sometimes, where if she had really said, I wonder if she's the one who actually offered it. Like, because why would he just randomly say, hey, let's just go stay at your dad's? Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. So I'm almost wondering if she wanted this to happen at some point. So there's, like we all have agreed, this movie has a lot to unpack. There's tons in it. And that's what makes it so cool, because you could talk about this movie for days.
I'm really glad that the female on the show is the one that said that.
Yeah, because I am obviously, and this is why I was very glad that I was really hoping you were going to be in on the episode. Because the whole first half of the rape scene left me completely confused.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because of the way she responded to it and the way you phrase it. Right. And it's, and that's something where I'm going to have a real hard time putting my head in her head. Right. And so I'm glad you were here to clarify that.
And all you women out there who are pissed at me, you can send hate mail right to my website. Don't even bother with dark discussions. Just go to my website and send it to my contact form, and I'll be happy to respond to you.
Well, and again, I got to say, I keep going back to the era, and sexual politics were a very different thing. I mean, we're old enough to remember the line, your mouth says no, but your eyes say yes. Right?
Yes, yep, totally. And I mean, listen, I've lived through in the early 90s, there was a supposed rape on campus at the University of Rhode Island at the school where I went to. And the girl had gone into a fraternity house. It made 2020 because of this same type of controversy where it was, you know, I'm not even going to go into it here, but it was the same type of controversy. Let's just leave it at that. And they did catch the guy eventually, but it turned out to be the wrong guy. And so they demonized this guy, and then the guy ended up hanging himself. And I was working the night that he hanged himself, actually. I was working in the security office with another friend of mine. But what's interesting is that, you know, this, I guess my point in bringing that up is that this wasn't just something going on in the 70s. It wasn't, it was also going on in the early 90s. That wasn't that long ago. That really wasn't that long ago. If you think about it, that was what, 27 years ago, and sexual politics were different. And like you just said, Mike, all of us on this show, except for Abe, who's younger, we actually remember the evolution of a lot of this, at least from, let's say, the early 80s, right? when we were teenagers.
Yeah. And I'm going to shout out the Midnight Drive-In podcast, because they often talk about movies from the 80s and talk about how they were exceptionally rapey. And because it was just a lot more acceptable back then than it is now.
Right. Yeah. Well, even if it wasn't necessarily seen again, which is why at the time is rape. And a good example being the one that people have talked about a lot lately was the Revenge of the Nerds.
Right. Yeah.
Where I think it's Gilbert goes down on Betty and posing as Stan. And so, but because she likes it afterwards, it's okay.
Right.
You know, whereas that now that would be seen as sexual assault. Right. But part of it is, again, you have to be really careful about taking current sexual mores and understanding of sexual relationships and necessarily transporting it back to where people's minds were 30 years ago.
Yes. And there's a lot of that in this movie in particular, because I was referring earlier to Dustin Hoffman's character's sexism. Maybe that wasn't really seen as sexism when the movie was made. Maybe that's just the way guys talk to their wives. Who knows?
Or at least
the little woman doesn't do the work. You know what I mean? That's still what's going on.
Or it may not even be men and women dynamics as a core of the whole country. It may have just been these two people. And this was just another shot between the two people in the character arcs. You know, I mean, that was his way to say insult his wife. You know, it may have not been, oh, let's put this in for a specific reason for women's rights or men being dinks or whatever. And you know what I'm saying? So it could have just been this, let's write it because this is how the character is. He's an asshole.
Mm-hmm. But I'm saying that I perceive his remarks in 2019 as being sexist. Yeah. And in 1971, those remarks may not have been perceived as being sexist. That's the point I was trying to make.
Right. If in 1971, if they weren't perceived as sexist, I think based off of how the character arc is, they were at least looked at as being him being a dink to his wife.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anyway.
And that's, you know what, Eric, that is a super good point, and I am so glad you brought that up. I'm really glad you brought that up, but I know we've talked about it on this show before. The serious danger sometimes is that everybody in this society forgets that the world was not always this way.
It was certainly not.
Like, I crack up when they say, oh, like in Bohemian Rhapsody. Okay, I went to see Bohemian Rhapsody. Okay, nowhere near the amount of cigarette smoking that there should have been in that film.
Okay.
It was a lot of what they were showing us was the 70s in nightclubs or, you know, and especially in England, you know, it's like, and, you know, why were people not constantly chain smoking? They did a good job. They showed a lot of smoking, but not nearly enough. Everybody smoked all the time, everywhere.
I don't know if it's an unspoken agreement, even it might be a spoken agreement, but you're not supposed to show any more smoking in your movies than you have to. Because it'll influence the kids.
Right. But I see Christy's point because it's a period piece.
Right. I know what she's saying.
Yeah, it's a period piece, and that's exactly it. When you
especially in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's just what we have to take into consideration. I mean, that may be not exactly the best example, but like Mike said, you know, in the 80s, things were more rapey. You know, just looked at completely differently, and just the way it was, you know. And
if I'm not mistaken, though, wasn't this rape scene, I mean, first of all, the rape scene, well, it was a big deal even back in 71, just for the fact that, as Mike said, for one reason, which is it was the beginning of the change in cinema, and it shocked everybody. The second reason it was a big deal was because of what Mike was discussing earlier as well, which is, was she into it or not? And that was a huge thing. And if you read a lot of articles and critiques and reviews of the film, even from back in 1971, people were writing that in the review. Like, she's raped, but she's into it, and is this outrageous or not? And so it was a big thing, and not just some you know, oh, it's just another rape film or a rapey scene from a film.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right, and because this is someone that she's been has a relationship with, and because it's someone who she's been flirting with up to that point in the movie, that's why it's confusing. It's not just a matter of, you know, someone that she had no connection with in that way before, like it is with whoever the second man is again, who comes
but,
in
but,
there.
Scott. But also, Scott. The other thing, too, about it is even though he hits her a couple of times, which is horrible because you never hit a woman, the problem is that this scene, when they start, when the rape does occur, it's not where, like we've seen in other scenes, where some woman who knows the person and may have even been in a relationship with the person is then beaten up to the point of like a pulp and is raped, like we've seen in other films. Like I can't think of any offhand, thank God. But
well, and also, you know, now these are filmmakers, right? These are Hollywood guys. They may have been looking at, well, this is a culture, the backwoods people, where wasn't that long ago where hitting your wife wasn't that bad of a thing.
Yep. No. That's very true. There are cultural differences that we often forget about. And in addition, I'd also like to add, too, in, you know, where you were saying that, where, you know, I was talking earlier about, you know, interpreting why it looked like she might have wanted it or whatever. You know, there's another thing I forgot to mention, and that is, well, if she did actually have a previous relationship with this guy, this might have been the way that he fucked her. She was just used to it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That just might be what she was used to. You know, if you have a relationship with a guy and you don't see him for, I mean, I don't know how long she hadn't been in the town, but let's say she hadn't seen him for, I don't know, 10 years or 20 years or whatever. She hasn't seen him for a long time. So there's a familiarity. If you were, you know what I mean? It's, and if he was violent and that was the way he made love to her, she just might have been used to it. And been just like, yeah, it's all familiar to me. This
well,
is
well, and it's also
oh,
like said,
down
Chrissy,
memory lane. Yay. You know, I really
Chrissy, also is like you said, which is if she was in a relationship with him and he was alpha male to the point where she was scared of him, you know, it was an abusive relationship. This is the norm for her too. So,
exactly.
And we don't know enough about any of these characters, except that we know everybody has a history and this and that, but we don't know enough to really know. But so that could be possible too. Let me ask about the other points that weren't as obvious to the film, which is, but were most certainly there, which is the backwardsness of rural people and the ugly American and the elitist intellectual compared to the yokels and all that. What did you guys think of all those? I know that's a bunch of things, but I saw all those things in the film and I wasn't sure what they were trying to say, whether they were just stereotyping and making them all caricatures of what a ugly American is or what an intellectual elite jerk is or what a rural hobunkin boob is or redneck is. I don't know if they were caricatures or if the screenwriter, which was Peckinpah and the other guy, were just dense and said, oh, all people from New York and California are, or from a university, are all intellectual jerks, or all Americans are pompous asses when they go to foreign countries, and all rural people, whether they're in England or the U.S. are just backwards hicks. I don't know if that was intentional or if they were just caricatures. Yeah, Mike, you insist on that?
My understanding of Peckinpah, and it's a really thinly grasped concept of Peckinpah, is Peckinpah sounded like a rough living, you know, drinking, drug using, smoking, gun toting kind of guy. You know, he lost out on directing the Superman gig because he brought a gun to the interview. So I have a feeling he's the kind of guy who would be criticizing, that would be looking down on the Dustin Hoffman character for being a wuss. Mm-hmm. That's me, that he's more the real man will stand up and fight. And that might even extend, which might be why so many people were willing to criticize the film as being misogynistic. That might go out into his real life. I have no idea what his relationship with his wife was. Apparently they got like married and divorced like 3 times. So I really don't know what his relationship there was. But it's not hard to read into it that he had probably more sympathy with. But, you know, again, I don't think he's like I don't know if he's criticizing ugly Americans necessarily. I think he's criticizing Dustin Hoffman's specific type of people, you know, which is the beta male, the people who the males who don't have a backbone and won't stand up and fight. You know, that the reason he left his home is because he didn't want to fight. And I think he's criticizing that. And at the same time, you know, a man who has a woman that is kind of walking all over him and is constantly kind of poking fun at his masculinity.
What right? About the rural people and their trashness?
And then the rural people, well, there are those people, right? I don't think you can make that argument for the entire group, right? You have, you know, the bartender seemed like a decent guy. The major, was it?
Yeah, which is the constable. They call him Major Scott or whatever.
Right, and he seemed like a decent guy. So I don't want to draw too broad a brush with all of them. But he's got a bunch
of Episcopal's minister's wife was seen pretty normal.
Right, and yeah. even within the four knuckleheads,
even Janice, who was the daughter of the uncle of the knuckleheads, seemed normal. I mean, she's just a teenage girl that knew she was hot and was whatever. But anyway, go on, Mike.
Right, so even of the four knuckleheads that were working on building the thing or doing the repairs.
Yeah, roofing. The roofing.
The roofing. The two of them were involved in the rape.
Yeah.
We don't know who was involved in the cat thing.
Right.
The other two may have really been completely just goofballs, you know, who were having fun with them. You know, and then the things that happen at the end get out of control, and you can get into the whole mob mentality thing right there. So I'm not even sure how bad all of those guys were. You know, you might have a sort of a sliding scale from the one who is the worst, you know, right, as you know, as the leader of the pack. So, I mean, nowadays this would be, you know, they would all be stamped toxic masculinity, right? But of course, at the same time, the toxic masculinity is what Dustin Hoffman pulls out at the very end to save the David Warner character, who may have just murdered a small girl, but he didn't know that.
Right, right. Well, and plus, whether or not he pulls it out and does the manhood thing, technically he's right, because these people shouldn't be, you know,
right,
in his house if he says you have to leave, and they shouldn't be trying to take away somebody even if they want him, because his point, which is the law and the hospital, has the right to do this, not you.
Right. But I can also understand if you think that someone, you know, there's a region vigilante justice is a thing. It wasn't always. Yeah, again, I want to point out again, this is a completely a place where the book apparently diverges completely. Because the two other big differences in the book is the rape does not happen in the book.
Okay.
And if you remove the rape scene, then those characters become a whole lot
less evil.
Less evil and less unsympathetic. And at the same time, in the end, the character, the David Warner character, is in prison, and stealing from the new Halloween film, the prison bus like overturns and he escapes, and
right, he is a bad guy.
He is a bad guy.
Well,
the girl is only like 8 years old or a young girl, and she wanders off. She never comes into contact with him, but everyone hears the guy escaped. He does get run over. They assume that he's done something to her, and she eventually just shows up at the end unharmed. She's just a little girl who wandered off, and everyone jumps the gun. So they're more clearly,
so it's completely different. It's not a Mike Schmidt thing, like in the
right. So they're more clearly in the wrong there,
right? And that ties more into the mob mentality theme. that right. I was talking yeah, right. about, which is kind yeah, of yeah, the, yeah, there the, in this the, yeah, movie, the, but not really. I mean, it's there, but it's not like, you know, it's like when David like takes the guy in his house and says, you can't, whatever. Like, he's trying to be like, hey, this is not, you know what I mean? We don't have proof of this, so we really shouldn't be doing anything. Right? Because right. he tries to protect him, doesn't he?
So in the book, it's true mob mentality, while in the movie, even though no one knows where Janice is, but except the audience, it looks more apt to be, you know, people pissed off that this guy may have done something to their loved girl, the girl that they love. So it doesn't look as mob mentality until it is mob mentality. In other words, when they go to get David Warner, it makes sense because they want to talk to him and say, where the hell is Janice? What did you do to Janice? So it makes sense that they would want to talk to him. It becomes a mob mentality when David says, well, you know, we have to wait for the cops. And then that's when the true mob mentality. But, well, actually, no, right? Because they beat up Warner's brother at the church. They beat him to a pulp, and we don't even know if he's dead.
No, they actually sent him running to look for his brother. They tell him to go look for him, and then decide, and that's when they go to the bar to get completely hammered before they go out for the vigilante justice.
Right,
because that's a good idea.
Yeah.
So they were already in a mob mentality when they beat up the brother.
Yeah.
At that point. So yeah, all right. So they were mob all the way from the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah, it just sounds to me like the book. The black and white is a little, it is more black and white in terms of it, and Peckinpah really
grays it.
Yeah, purposely muddies the waters, makes the leads less likable, makes the bad guys less likable, or more clearly villainistic or on one end, and at the same time gives you better or more of a reason to justify the mob mentality at the end, too. So, yeah, this is why it's a fascinating film. Even if it's a tough watch, because
what's interesting too, Mike, is that the father of Janice, the uncle of basically the four jerks, he actually has that whole scene in the bar where he's a prick, and that was obviously intentional to make us think he's a prick and you know just trash, because at the end of the film when we know. Us, the audience, knows that Janice is in trouble and possibly dead. He's just a father looking for his daughter and her safety. So by making him a dirtbag right at the beginning of the film, it makes us less sympathetic to him when he is out looking for his daughter and for her safety. And that was obviously intentional as well by Seth Peckinpah to, like you said, muddy the waters. So let's wrap up. Final thought to the film. And whatnot. Eric, why don't you start?
Okay. I really enjoyed the conversation we had tonight. I think I enjoyed talking about this movie way more than I enjoyed watching this movie. There's clearly some stuff in here to analyze. Watching it, I thought almost all the characters were despicable, and it really reinforced my attitude that people suck. Peckinpah is apparently on my side there. I'm going to say this is not a movie that I enjoyed watching. It's a movie that I enjoyed talking about, and your mileage may vary. So if you're into movies with super dark themes, go ahead and give it a watch.
All right, very good. When Chris Genro, who was the Patreon supporter that had picked this film, chose it, and it was actually picked randomly by us. I was kind of disappointed because, like I said, I had seen the film like 5 or 6 years ago, and I was like, meh on it. But after rewatching it last night and really paying attention, I thought the film was fantastic. As Eric stated, I felt this conversation was really good. And enjoyed talking about this film more so than some of our other episodes. So this one episode was really enjoyable for me, as well as the watching a great film. So I would recommend the film, but again, it's an older film, and depending on if you like that weird 70s film of that era will determine whether or not you like this film. Another film that came out this year, too, in 71, that I forgot to mention, that was very violent, too, was Dirty Harry. So that was another one. So it was an interesting time, for sure, 1971. Mike?
Yeah, I'm glad I watched it. This is an uncomfortable watch. It's really hard to say I enjoyed the film. That doesn't mean it's a bad film. It is something that will stimulate conversation. I don't know how much of that's intentional. I don't know how much of that's what Peckinpah wanted or what happened because of who and the kind of person Peckinpah is. There are people who trash this film and call it vile and amoral and reprehensible. And on a certain perspective, I can understand that if you view it a certain way, although he clearly, Peckinpah did say he did not advocate, it was not being done as rape advocacy, right?
Right.
And again, Mike, I have some confusion as to was she willing or not in the beginning? But he clearly meant to say that was not saying that she's into rape, right? That wasn't what he was trying to say with that. Or try to use that as an excuse for rape. But there's a lot more. If you remove the rape part of it, the film is less controversial. And I guess that's one of the problems I have with it, is that I don't think the rape scene was necessary in the movie.
Yeah, without the rape scene, it's just a home invasion film at the end.
Yeah, but I still think the point kind of comes through. And wow, there really is just so much to discuss about this. There really should be a podcast. But yeah, I would if this is the kind of film that you would be into, but by this point, if you don't know that or not, by now I don't know what you're listening to. Some people can handle material, by which I mean can watch and are willing to watch material that is rough. This is definitely rough. And people who don't want to do it, who want to beg out of it, I understand that perfectly. I'm kind of sick and tired of watching rape films myself. Yeah, I'm glad I finally got this off my bucket list. I probably will never watch it again. I might maybe a few years down the road, but no time soon.
All right, Abe.
This is a well shot film. It's a well acted film, and it's certainly from watching, I can definitely see why it had its status in film history. That being said, it's definitely something that's going to be a hit and miss with folks. Some folks might be deterred by the content. Others might be able to gravitate and find it is actually, to the other alley. There's a lot to dissect as you heard tonight, and there's probably more that we haven't got a chance to really look at. It's, not a film I might revisit, but it's one I can definitely recommend within the film genre. It's a strong film, but it's definitely one that it will have to find certain people who could get into it. It's not gonna be for everybody, and that's okay. That's the thing of all the movies. This one's just has a bit of a is understand the controversy behind it is understandable, but it's definitely a staple in film, and that's important to keep in mind.
All right, Chrissy.
Well, this film certainly has a lot of layers in it. If you go into it looking at it as art, there is quite a bit to talk about. Yes, the rape is what makes it controversial. The rape is the thing that everybody remembers and everyone talks about. It does have that certain 70s kind of grit to it. I think if you can handle things like Deliverance and Dirty Harry, you can probably handle this. And just keep in mind that if you are sensitive, this was made in a completely different time by a director who shot a lot of Westerns. So you really need to keep your perspective and your expectations in check if you're going to watch this type of material. I think everybody should see it if they can handle it just because it is a quality film, but I do understand that not a lot of people are going to be able to relate to it or enjoy it. I myself probably would not watch it again. I mean, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years from now, I might be like, oh, you know, there's an opportunity for me to watch Straw Dogs because I have to write a paper on it or something. I don't necessarily think I would sit down and watch it again voluntarily unless I needed it to do it for some kind of project. But I would recommend it. So that's
now,
it.
Now, has anybody seen the 2013 remake? And I was just curious. No,
I know I watched it. I don't remember anything from it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I know it got very, negative reviews, like 30% good reviews, and that's it. So I was just curious if anybody had seen it. All right. Very good. So, that's, 1971 Sam Peckinpah's, classic horror thriller, whatever you want to call it. Straw Dogs, Roger Ebert at the time only gave it 2 out of 4 stars, which was interesting, but, it has 87% good reviews at this point on Rotten Tomatoes. And is considered by most film critics as a classic, one of the films that helped Dustin Hoffman make the career that he did, and a film that, is now a Criterion Collection. With all that said, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in tonight to listen to us talk about Straw Dogs. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.